Thanks for joining in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We are going to talk with you about insects today. They are fascinating creatures, and who knows more about them than Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, director of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. Always great to have Phil come by. I know you'll have questions for him, and I hope you'll call in. 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
Great to have you. I've been hearing a lot about fruit flies and some problems, and it's sort of it's a specific or a special.
Yeah, fruit fly, you know, the crazy thing, there is 113 species of Drosophila fruit fly in the United States. And so we always have fruit flies. What's significant about this year is for the first time in Wisconsin, and Minnesota has very similar problems, we have an outbreak of an Asian species we call the spotted wing Drosophila. First picked up in 2008 in the West Coast. We had seen samples in 2010 and 11 in traps, but no damage. What's suffering the most is our fall raspberry crop. And what makes this fruit fly different, it can lay its eggs in the fruit just as they start to color. So the maggots will cause a quick decay, whereas traditionally you associate fruit flies with damaged, broken down, falling apart fruit.
Yeah.
And so it's a whole different ball game. And you know, we can walk this back probably to infestations that got here by middle of July, maybe before that. We're somewhat confused if this was a blow-in. We've seen so many exotic things blown up this year, or is this evidence of overwintering and the like? And so that's a question we're going to have to tackle this next year or so. But the bottom line is for fall raspberry producers, this will be a problem. The high tunnel people might be battling this for the next 5 or 6 weeks. So it is of significance.
Facebook question from Christy. We had one lonely firefly lighting up around the yard until a couple of weeks ago. Do they all die, or do they just go dark?
Well, there's a number of different species. And traditionally, you think of most fireflies being out in late June to early July. But this year, I've noticed species well into, you know, I haven't captured, I've seen them flashing. And so I think it's just a different complex of species being active. In general, though, the things that fireflies prey upon do well in lush years. This has not been a lush year,
no.
So I guess I'm not surprised that their numbers are down.
And a Facebook question from Mary Ann. I have stink bugs decimating my pole beans in Bayfield County. This has never happened before. Anything I can do at this point? Probably not.
I mean, if there's still stink bugs feeding, you know, every time they feed and puncture, they're going to cause either a blemish or a distortion of the bean. You know, most garden sprays will take care of them. We've been worried about this Asian marmorated stink bug. We have not been seeing any evidence of that. I only saw one sample this year so far. But the green stink bug, which is more of a southern creature, seems to be quite widespread. Again, one would speculate maybe we had some blow-ins, and they're basically fruit pests. So they'll cause blemishes on tomatoes. The beans, again, can get hit. Grapes, raspberries to some degree. If you're going to continue to expect to harvest things, and there's more than about one stink bug per row foot, that's enough to cause damage.
Ellen in Wausau, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Say, I've got earwigs that like to burrow themselves in the center of my dahlia flowers.
Yeah, well, I mean, earwigs are kind of interesting because they do all their feeding at night, and in the day they like to hide in places. And so the question is, are they just hiding out there, or they feed on all kinds of things. They like flower petals. They also like other insects. I've gotten in trouble for saying this, but they're like goats. They eat anything. The problem is not that they breed in the dahlia flower. They breed in the ground. And so anytime you are addressing an earwig problem, you treat the ground, not the plant.
Okay.
But that would have to be, I mean, the earwigs have been active since the 1st of June. And so that's really the time to shut the door. There's only one generation a year. And so if they're bad, we try to treat them relatively early in the summer, not this late. It really is not effective to treat them this late.
So what could I do next year? Is there something I can put on the ground around the plant to avoid them?
Yeah. Do you have those dahlias mulched or not?
Yes.
Okay. So what I would suggest is when you see the first signs of activity in is that early to midsummer, you treat your most landscape sprays, you know, the bug be gones and the home defenses and whatnot, those all work. But what you need to do is soak the mulch. And so this is one of those cases where getting one of these hose end attachments where you're literally putting a lot in so it soaks down into the mulch where the earwigs are hiding would be the most effective.
Okay. I'm just curious, though, what are they doing in the very center of the flower?
Well, it's one of two things. In the day, they're hiding because they don't want to be caught out in the sun. But the other side is you have to watch because it would not surprise me. They're also feeding on the flower petals as it starts to open.
Yeah, it looks like that. Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Thomas in Manitowoc, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I was working in my wood shop yesterday, and I had the planer going, which is extremely loud. I'm wearing earplugs and earmuffs, and the mosquitoes and the wasps, like, they're not affected by the loud noise. How come they're not, but all the other animals are running in panic, and the mosquitoes and the wasps seem to have no fear whatsoever of loud noises?
Well, insects don't have ears, and so they don't hear. In fact, what can complicate this story is some mosquitoes find their mate by the wing beat frequency. And so there's certain pitches that will attract certain insects. I can't say that that's going on for sure, but generally speaking, we find it's similar. You know, people have talked about even cockroaches. They've done the experiments where you basically take a police siren, and when you set it off, you may get a reaction initially, but in a matter of just a few minutes, they adapt and adjust to it because it doesn't pose any threat. So I think the first thing is they don't sense the world like we do. But secondly, in this case, as I said, if anything, I would think certain sounds would be more likely to attract them than send fear in their hearts.
Okay, then if they can't hear, why do cicadas and crickets make their...
Well, no. Okay. So as a general rule, insects don't hear, but there are certain insects that do communicate with each other. And so in the case of crickets, it is true. One cricket can make a sound that other crickets react to. It's both a territorial and a mating call. And the same with cicadas. So there are some instances, but as a general rule, insects don't use sound to communicate.
Okay, great deal. Thanks.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Phil Pelletier, UW Extension entomologist, our guest today. Join in at 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a photo there. And even if you can't post a photo, you should come and take a look at what's there. Jerry has been saving a moth here for you to ID. Bill, do you know what it is?
Well, I could tell for sure it's a sphinx or hawk moth. I am suspicious it's the blind sphinx. But the thing that I cannot see, way it is if the forewings were pushed forward so I could see a good picture of the hindwings. It should have a little blue spot in a black background there. There's also a walnut sphinx that's similar. There's a one-eyed sphinx. So it's definitely in that group, and I think it's the same genus as either the blind or one-eyed sphinx, but I can't tell you the species with the picture.
All right. Well, here we've got another one from George. Predatory wasp with a caterpillar. It said, stop flying long enough for me to take the picture. This is another cool picture.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sphecid. I can't tell what species. There really is numerous ones, but they're all predators, and each have their own characteristic prey. So some feed on caterpillars, some feed on crickets, some feed on spiders and the like. And, you know, this kind of wasp doesn't have a nest, per se. It usually creates a burrow or a similar environment. It puts its prey in there that's been paralyzed. It lays its egg, and then it's gone. And so the young develop on their own, and that's why we refer to them as solitary wasps. And as I said, there are dozens and dozens of species of those out there, and you can only make the argument that they're doing good because a lot of times the things that they're preying on would be considered garden pests.
And there's one more here that I really like. He wanted to know the difference between wasps and hornets.
Technically, there's no species difference to an entomologist. A wasp and a hornet and a yellow jacket could all be the same name. I mean, there's a great difference between bees and wasps. I mean, bees collect pollen. They have very characteristic hairs on their body. And their whole biology is different, whereas wasps generally are predators. But in some cases, they're used interchangeably. In some cases, only large species are referred to as hornets. So as I said, it really is very confusing, and there's not what you would call a clean definition.
And we got a beautiful photo of a praying mantis on the Facebook page as well. They're interesting animals, aren't they?
We've talked about this on the show before, is that, you know, mantids are now breeding in the state. And we have two species for sure, the Chinese mantid and the European mantid. And the only way I can tell them quickly apart is if you get the right shot, the European mantid has a little black spot up on its forewing. And the story is that even though neither of these are native, in the past, they could not survive a winter. Their eggs would freeze out, but this doesn't happen anymore. And so, you know, I've seen specimens from Door County this year. I've seen them in the southern third of the state from a number of places. And, but for a lot of people, it's still a relatively new experience, and it's fun.
It is.
And they make great photographic subjects. So,
Kim in Loganville, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
See, I wanted to call and thank you for your show. I have learned that Phil Pelletarian is like the bug god, and kudos to you because I don't know if you remember me, but I emailed you these bugs, and you identified them as the strawberry root weevils. And my daughter and I were freaking out, couldn't figure out how the bugs were getting in. And you gave me the information on how to get them gone, and you did it. You are awesome.
Well, thank you.
Thank you from the bottom of our hearts. We could sleep after we got the message. It was vacuuming, and it was just freaking me out. So I got it fixed, and I figured out how to do it because you are awesome, and you know your business. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
Well, that's pretty nice.
Yeah, well, you know, and I'm sure there's probably a couple people out there would maybe not agree with you because the advice didn't work as well as we wanted it to.
Thank you, Kim. That's great. I really appreciate your call and compliment for Phil. And here's another Phil from Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hey, you guys. Good morning. Phil, I wanted to pass along some information that you probably already know about our new little stink bug. I was at a garden center show in Chicago and ran into a guy that does a lot of work with pheromone traps. And he said they had developed a pheromone trap for our new happy stink bug that was very effective. And he told me a very long story. But he said the military had supplied a lot of the funding. And he said, I know I sell traps for a living, but this trap works. And he said, have you seen the bug yet? And I said, no, I don't think I have. And he goes, look a little harder. He said a period of time ago he was in Missouri at a large garden center and trying to talk him in, of course, to buying some of his product. And he started describing the new stink bug to the lady. And he said she pulled out a quart Ziploc bag from under the counter stuffed full of stink bugs. She said, do you have a moment? And they walked out the back of the garden center, and they were also large vegetable and raspberry producers on several acres behind the garden center. And he said, I saw damage that exceeded any beetle damage I have ever seen in my life. This bug is unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, you know, but the interesting thing, and this, I was up at the Farm Tech Show back in July, and I had a gentleman stop by from Maryland and told the story about how they had to spray all their soybeans. His wife was there. She said that their shop vac, they burned the motor out because it clogged because of all the stink bugs in the house. And, you know, I know that's been the story out east, but the interesting conversation was, he said, where are they? And I said, what do you mean? He said, we can't find them this year. And so did a little bit of digging, and the population is imploding. It is decreasing out east, and I honestly, we don't know why. Is this a quirk of the year or the like? I was extremely encouraged with that because so far, the brown marmorated stink bug, the only verified samples we have had have been out of Brown County 1, Jefferson County 1, Dane County, I've seen 3 or 4, and then we've had a couple intercepts. And the question we've been asking is, why aren't we seeing more? Because, you know, this has been about 2 years it's been festering. And so I'm hoping that the story out east is what we see here. But, yes, that was the Japanese beetle to your fruit and vegetables as far as damage, and then the Asian lady beetle as far as invading your home. And so it is just an extremely unpleasant bug. Now, there's no way about it.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Ted in Wausau has a question for you, Phil, so let's go to Ted. Hi, Ted.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I just moved into a new apartment, and the second we laid some fruit out, we just got a swarm of them, and we've tried cleaning the sink and everything. I was wondering if there's just a good tip on how to get rid of them.
Fruit flies.
Yeah, well, what it comes down to is the maggots of the fruit flies breed on yeast, and we find that yeast associated with things that are overly ripe and fermenting and usually have a sugar base because that's what the yeast is feeding off of. And so the source has to be found. There is just no, I mean, you can put out vinegar traps and catch some flies, but it's kind of like if there's still a fire in the corner, till the fire's put out, you've still got the problem. And so it takes detective work. You know, we look for rotting bulbs, you know, bad squash. I look in the bottom of garbage cans to see things are caked. I honestly would look to see if there's some kind of leak from a garbage disposal, because that kind of syrupy mess that could come from that would be exactly the kind of thing that could ferment. You know, fruit flies have a pretty quick turnover, and so usually when the source is removed and cleaned up, things improve dramatically within a couple days. It was interesting. We had a minor outbreak in the house, and you know, I couldn't think of anything indoors. But I do remember, you know, we have a trash container. We put all of our vegetable matter for composting and stuff. Or not vegetable matter, but plants in particular. But I found a couple of bad tomatoes, and I had thrown them in there. So they're breeding in the garage and showing up in the kitchen is what it came to. And once I disposed of that, it was good. So I hate to say it, but it's all about detective work. There's just no other easy answer to it.
Sure. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Ted. Michael in Phillips, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, and good morning.
Morning.
I've been battling hornets and wasps for many years now on my property, and I live in town. And I've worked to, you know, tug up all the holes on the buildings and knock down nests and things like that. This year we had some in the ground, and I was able to find their nests and destroy those as well. What I'm trying to find out is I'm trying to learn if there's anything available, like in the way of traps, to prevent them from starting. I did those sugar traps, you know,
You're breaking up,
but basically not, for two reasons. A number of the species have absolutely no interest in either sugars or people food, and so there's no traps for those. And the only one that really we had some luck, and honestly I'd say it was marginal luck, is for the yellow jackets that scavenge on either proteins or sugar in the late summer. And the problem there is that the only reason they go to that is they run out of regular food. And so this doesn't happen in the spring. And so the traps really are a little bit misleading. In general, you know, they can help to some degree if you have a problem late summer around picnics. But even then, I think they're somewhat marginal. So unfortunately, there is no trap. And people have been working on this. They, you know, you would be able to make quite a bit of money if you could come up with the ultimate wasp trap. But I have not seen it yet.
Thanks, Michael. Vicki and Merrill. Hi, thank you for calling.
I was made aware of this problem last night, and I went out and checked this morning, and I can't believe your show is just at the perfect time. So the problem is we live in Merrill where there was a lot of trees that went down in windstorms, and we have one right outside our door, and there are no bugs on the tree stump itself, but there's a huge collection of these little orange bugs that you could scoop up in by handfuls. They're all over the sidewalk, and they're crawling in the leaves adjacent to where that tree went down. The tree was a basswood, and the bugs are about different life stages, so a quarter to maybe 3/8 inch long. They're they're slender with a bulbous behind, and they're burnt orange with either blackish wings or blackish markings on the side.
Yeah, I think they're box elder bugs.
Box elder. Is that something we should get rid of?
Well, the only problem with box elder bugs is they do really no harm to our plants, but in the fall of the year, they like to crawl into people's houses to spend the winter, and so they're a nuisance. Now, you know, just because they're around that tree doesn't mean they're coming into your house,
right?
But this is the time to get after them, is when they're congregated and clustered like that. You can kill them with soapy water. You can kill them with most landscape or household sprays. It's not the end of the world if you miss it. It's just that all winter long you'll find a few box elder bugs. The immature stages can't survive. It's only the adults that are successful in overwintering. But, you know, this, if any year you're going to see a lot of them, it's this year, because they do pretty well when it's hot and dry. And I have been getting quite a few complaints probably for the last 5 weeks about box elder bugs.
Hmm.
Now, will they eventually kill trees?
No. They are basically a seed feeder. And so maples and box elder are the primary hosts.
Okay, and if we do away with them, is there any bird species that's going to go without their dinner this
year? No, in fact, to be honest, they're somewhat distasteful. That's why they're so bright. Anytime an insect's brightly colored, it's advertising something, and usually it doesn't taste very good.
All right, sounds like it's doom and gloom for box elder bugs.
All right, thanks, Vicki. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We had an email here. Jenny in Thiensville wants to get rid of centipedes in her house. They find and kill 4 to 6 centipedes on the main floor of our ranch house every week. We have sealed cracks in the basement. Pay attention to humidity levels. Nothing seems to help. Not a fan of chemicals with 2 dogs in the house. Is there a way to get rid of this problem without spraying?
Well, the first question, because this is an unusually high number, is are these outdoor centipedes or is this, there is a species that we only find indoors called the Mexican house centipede. Scutigera is the genus. And the story would be different because if the source is outside, they continue migrating in, and it's still a question of trying to head them off at the pass that way. If it's the indoor species, my first question is there'd have to be an awful lot for centipedes to eat to have those kind of numbers. And so I'm a little confused with that. But if you're looking for a pretty much non-toxic way of helping reduce the populations, we use the, what are called glue boards or sticky boards. It's the same thing that they use occasionally for catching mice. It is a sticky cardboard-like material. You have to be a little careful where you place it if you got pets, but you know, underneath refrigerators and back of places, things can't go, and if it crawls through, it gets caught. And the thing about centipedes, they don't breed quickly. Many of them take a year or more to get mature and go through a generation. And so, as I said, by removing just even a couple females, you're going to make a significant difference down the road. But I go back to the question is, are they, you know, outdoor types of centipedes that are migrating in, which is kind of a dead end for them, or is this Scutigera, which is a tropical centipede that will thrive indoors? Scutigera's got the longer legs, runs like crazy, scares the heck out of people. But one of the arguments is they're eating critters in your house, which probably is something you don't want to have. So
we have Gary and DePier who has a question for you, Phil. Hi, Gary.
I was on my day off one time. I normally watch some ants on my patio porch from time to time when I don't have anything else to do. But I put some squirrel, nets up for a squirrel from time to time, and he would come along and eat these things. And one day, they were watching the ants scurry across. I put some nuts out. He ate them, and a bunch of ants come up there and became stationary, like they were dead in these different spots. And few of them would scurry on by them. The squirrel came back in about a half hour. They all scattered because they weren't dead. When he left, they all came back and took up these stationary positions again. And I didn't have a drink that day, and I wasn't catatonic. What was going on out there anyway?
But there was no evidence that they were feeding on anything?
They were just stationary. They weren't not moving, except for a few other ones that were scurrying around the edge, and they were going back and forth across the patio.
I mean, the first thought, and although you wouldn't think there's enough oils coming from those nuts, but when I see ants stationary like that, I mean, ants are liquid feeders, believe it or not. And so, you know, if you have oil spots or other things or sugar spots if people spill pop, you can see this congregation of ants basically imbibing on the liquid, and then, of course, some of them, when they get their tummies full, will head off. So that would be the first thing I would investigate, is that there's some kind of residue that could have a food substrate base to it, and the ants were taking advantage of that.
Sure, but how still they were for so long.
Really strange. Thanks for calling, though, Gary. That's the best guess we have here. Ryan in Door County, what's on your mind? Hi.
Hi, I'm kind of going back to the box elder bug, but we have a side of our garage, and I think it's maybe because the sun beats on it. We've seen them earlier in the year and stuff like that, but now, right when we come into our house by our main door, there's thousands of, like, little tiny ones. I mean, is this the time of year that they mate, and what should we do just to kind of get rid of them? I'll just hang up and listen for the answer.
The odd thing about this year is that typically at this time of the year, there should be pretty much mature nymphs and adults, but this has been anything but a normal year, and I think they're trying to go through an additional generation. I don't think they'll be successful. I don't think there's enough of a growing season. So you've got a lot of immature box elder bugs. So they'll eventually die off, but it could easily be 3 to 4 weeks before that happens. Again, you could go and spray them with soapy water right now. One of my favorite stories is from doing this show, and this was many years ago. My colleague down at Iowa State always recommended a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water, and it's very effective, as is insecticidal soap and whatnot. But a caller called in and said, I tried Cheer and it didn't work. Well, it turns out soap chemistries differ, you know, and that's the crazy thing when people ask me about this. I'm very comfortable that you go to the garden store and buy insecticidal soap because I know what's in there. When you start talking about dishwashing liquids and you know, clothes washing stuff, I'm not sure what's in there. And so that's a little bit riskier business. And but, you know, dilute soap, mixtures, typically, if it's got the right fatty acids in there, will kill on contact. There's no residual there, though. And that's the difference between buying the stuff at the hardware store made for spraying on the side of the house is when you spray it, it will kill them for a couple of 3 weeks at least. And in general, what you tend to do is want to spray where it gets sunny in the morning to early afternoon, because that's the congregation sites.
Aaron emailed us. He says, we planted red milkweed this spring, hoping to attract monarchs, but ended up having thousands of these little milkweed bugs.
Mm-hmm.
What potential problems will we have with these if this is going to be an issue every year, or are they just a bad year?
Well, they come and go, you know, and they look very much like a box elder bug. When you look at them closer, they're a little bit more orange and not as reddish, but very similar. They cluster. They are a seed feeder on milkweeds. But I don't see them invading people's houses, so they're not a problem there.
They're going to chase away the monarchs?
No. Mm-hmm. The one argument I guess you could make is they will reduce the seed load of the plant, you know, so there'll be less seed. So if you're growing this in a prairie for seed distribution, then it would be considered a pest. But in any other situation, I really don't think. And they do ebb and flow. For whatever reason, this year on our butterfly weed out in front of the house, few and far between, whereas last year it was covered with them. And so you kind of see this. But this is an insect that when I was a graduate student and whatnot, it was not that common here, and it's become more common. I think it is more of a southern creature that's been extending its range, is at least my take on this.
Jay in Plum City. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Say, I have two questions, and my first question pertains to raspberries. For years, I've noticed, and this year too, that on certain berries, you'll find a little tiny, you can almost barely see a thread-like white worm or nematode-looking critter. And I'm wondering what they are and how you control them, because I don't particularly like eating little white fireworms.
Typically, when I think of true very thin worms, they're usually annelids or nematodes, and you don't expect them in berries. What we're seeing this year is the little white worms are fruit flies, but they tend to be a little bit thicker. So, you know,
I've seen these for years, 10, 20 years.
Oh, yeah, but we've had fruit flies here. It's just a question of the ripeness of the berry. And as I said, so without seeing the critter and seeing if it's got a head or legs or whatnot,
I'm almost sure it's a nematode, because they're fairly long but really thin, just like a little white thread.
Okay, well, if it is, though, you normally would not expect nematodes to be associated with fruit unless it was in contact with the ground.
Oh. Okay.
So, boy, you know, if you get one, throw it in some rubbing alcohol, send it off to me, and we'll see if we can get you a better answer.
Okay, great. A second question is on walnuts. I picked some black walnuts the other day, and the shells were green, and I was cutting into a couple of them, or, you know, trying to peel the shell off, and I noticed on quite a few of them they had little tiny maggots, full of little tiny maggots inside. Is there some kind of a walnut maggot fly?
It's called the walnut husk fly. To be honest, it's related to the apple maggot fly that causes us all the problem in the fruit. And it's a little pitcher wing fly, meaning it's got markings on the wings, lays its egg as the fruit develops, and the maggots go through the out part of the nut. They're really not a nut pest. It's more in the meat on the outside that you see them and cause staining and the like, but really nothing worse than that.
Okay, well, I mean, that's basically what I was wondering, and I said, would that cause a problem with the apple trees, if apple trees are nearby?
They're totally different species.
No problems there. Thanks, Jay. Thank you for calling. And Carol in Minocqua, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hello there. We had a couple of very large pine trees taken down in our yard this summer, and the trunks are still on the ground. They haven't been split and piled up yet. And there is some definite munching and crunching going on in there. You can hear it. You can see the sawdust underneath. Are these termites?
No.
And how? They're not.
No, the critter is called a pine sawyer, spelled S-A-W-Y-E-R. The genus is Monocamus. It's a longhorn wood borer. It's associated with dead and dying pines, but it will also attack logs and makes a lot of noise, makes a lot of mess with the sawdust that comes out. Doesn't pose any threat to healthy trees. The only problem I see with it is sometimes people will salvage these for logs and make log homes. And then in the first year or two, you get this big, ugly insect that comes out and makes all this noise. And other than cosmetic damage, it's no worse than that. But it is. In a lot of pine sawyers this year, I'm going to expect a lot of them the next couple of years, because we're going to have a lot of dead plant material because of this crazy weather. But again, when they're in a tree, a pine tree in particular, I know the trees, whether it looks dead or not, it's dead, because they would not be in a healthy tree.
Okay. So I don't have to be concerned about them jumping from the logs to my house. I have a cedar-sided house.
No, because the wood is too dry. It's not suitable, but it's also too dry.
Okay,
I see. Very good. Thank you.
Thanks, Carol. And Ruth in Madison. Hi.
Oh, good morning. Yes, I was wondering about something my mother told me was a locust. And on hot summer days, you would hear this sort of metallic kind of whine, sort of zzz, and it would go on for, you know, several, like 40, 50 seconds. And I haven't heard that in recent years, and I'm wondering what that animal was.
Yeah. Well, it was definitely a cicada. And to be honest, different cicadas have different calls. And so, in general, the cicadas were, I think, reasonable numbers. I heard them a couple weeks earlier than normal this year, but everything was earlier than normal. You still occasionally might hear one, but always in the day or early evening. Whereas if you only hear a rattle at night, then I'm more inclined to think it's one of the katydids. But I haven't seen any difference. In fact, we have, I think, officially 8 or 9 species of cicadas in Wisconsin. And then if you go south of it, there's even additional species. You can go to the University of Michigan, and they have a recording of all the common Midwestern species calls.
Hmm.
And you can literally identify the species if you listen careful enough to the calls.
So then these species, some of them, they're not all the 17-year.
No, the typical ones we have, we call dog day cicadas. The genus is Tibicine, and the dog days take 2 to 3 years for an individual to go through its life cycle, but there are ones out there every year. We only have one population of the 17-year cicada, and it's only found in parts of the southeast part of the state and kind of spotty at that. And that one came out back in, I think, 2007 or 2008, and we won't see that one for a while. And then up north, we have some other smaller cicadas. As I said, if you do some investigating, there's more species out there than people, I think, realize. But the dog day cicada group is the most common one people associate with.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. And Jackie and Trigo. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We live in northwest Wisconsin. We live out in the country. We have a pond by our house. And we have so many gnats, G-N-A-T-S, in our yard that I can't stand to be outside working in the garden or even walking the dog.
Oh.
And they get in through the screens, I'm thinking, at night when I'm reading, if I have a light on, there's just hundreds of them.
Okay.
Why do we, and this summer, I've never noticed them. We've lived out here for about 15 years.
Yeah, see, now when you say the term gnat, all it means to me is a small fly, and I can come up with 200 things that I would define as a gnat. So the first take is I'm guessing. But typically when I get this kind of call, there is a family that we call lake flies, and they do breed in aquatic situations. They are strongly attracted to light at night. And so depending on the winds blow and how far you are away from a big body of water, much like the people in Oshkosh deal with a Lake Winnebago lake fly, and it can be absolutely plague-like when the numbers are high in the right conditions. So my guess is that would be the first likely source, because it's behaving like lake flies do. But what I can't speak to so much is exactly where the original source might be in your neighborhood.
Right. And, you know, we live by a lake, Whalen Lake, and we have that little pond. But they get in the eyes. They get in your ears. They're not flies. They're really tiny little bugs.
Well, you know, an entomologist defines anything with one pair of wings as a fly.
Okay.
And so there are all kinds of things. And as I said,
well, how do we get rid of them? What do we do?
Well, two things. You really can't, I mean, unless you drain the lake, if that was a source.
Oh.
I would be a little careful about your lights, though, because that often is the story, is that security lights that you have on attract them, so you have to start playing around with using different colored bulbs that are less attractive.
Sure.
You also have to be careful, you know, if you've got your picture window exposed and you're looking out in the lake, which is exactly why you want to live there, realizing that the light that's coming out from the house is like a magnet in drawing these things there. And so
we can't even leave our windows open at night, you know, when it's cool.
I know.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right.
They come in.
Yes, because they're small enough to get through the screen.
Can you spray with anything outside?
Not very effective.
Okay.
You know, and as for one year to the next, I mean, insect populations go back and forth. That it would not be a normal problem if you've been there 15 years, you've only seen it once, unless there's been a major change in the ecology of the lake. This is just a natural phenomenon. There's lots of good things about lake flies. They feed fish and the like. It's just that they can be a nuisance when you get these mass emergencies. The adults only live for a couple of days. They're very short-lived, but that gives you a sheer idea of the biomass, the number of critters
but
that can
breed. This has been going on for most of the summer, though.
But it can be more than one species. I mean, when I say lake fly, there's 250 species of lake flies in the Midwest.
There you go, Jackie.
Oh, gosh. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Not probably what you wanted to hear, but there you have it. Marty and Madison, hi.
Hi. I heard you talking about fruit flies, and we have been struggling with them in our home. And I tried a system that I thought might work. It seems to be working, and wondered if you have any other suggestions for when you get them in your home. What I had heard was to take a plastic bottle, like a soda bottle, and you cut off the top and invert that top. So you've got like a V going down into the bottle. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And then you tape around the top and then put orange juice in it. And the fruit flies get in, but somehow, I don't know, they're too stupid to fly out. They get stuck in there and then drown or die. And right now I've got one on my counter and it's full of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, you can definitely find traps, and there's nothing magic about the orange juice. You can use vinegar, you can use beer, you can use it's anything that has a yeast base to it. And what happens with the orange juice is it starts to sour. That's because the yeast associated breaking down the sugars. And anything that's fruity smelling will draw them in. But you go back to the argument that all you're doing is draining the adult flies off that are flying around, and somewhere in the house is a breeding site. And if you can find that and clean it up, you're done. Whereas if you don't find the breeding site, it's going to be a constant drawing off of these adults. Now, the other thing that can happen this time of the year, you know, people are bringing tomatoes in from outside and other produce, and you can have fruit flies breeding on cracked tomatoes, and we know there's a lot of cracked tomatoes out there this year.
Okay.
You know, and but you could even be drawing them from outside, and that's the fascinating thing as we're doing this research trying to understand this Asian fruit fly is, as I said, I've got traps that we put vinegar traps out, and I can catch 2,000 flies in a day, easily, anywhere I put the trap. But, you know, thank goodness most of what I'm seeing is not this Asian species. But in the late summer, when you've got a lot of produce going out of condition and getting overly ripe, that's fruit fly heaven. So
okay, so that's probably where they're coming in, is from our garden produce.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling. Facebook question from George. Visited Wyalusing, Wisconsin in June, saw a tiny bug. Never seen before. It looks like a tiny piece of white cotton with wings.
Yeah. A type of woolly aphid, most likely the woolly alder aphid. They secrete this white waxy material that comes out as filaments, and so it kind of looks like flying cotton candy is the best way to describe it. And I had noticed when I was out in the woods in June in the western side of the state that there was woolly aphids flying around. And now at this time of the year, it's a different species, but you can find species of woolly aphids on crab apples and amelanchier and a lot of those related plants. They don't have quite as long a filament, so they look more like kind of a white fuzz. But if you look at it closely on the plants, the white fuzz is walking, and underneath that covering is a little aphid.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. You can join in with a question at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you have a photo of an insect you want to share or have a question about one at ID. Send that to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And, of course, you can post any question there as well. Jim in Ashland up next with a question. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi, Phil. Larry, I have a little farm out here in the woods up in Shawamigan. And I've been developing a prairie in the old fields, and I've actually been very successful. I have acres of prairie flowers, all different kinds. But yes, last year I noticed in one of my flowers that are really taken off, it's an oxeye, that along the stem there was some aphids up near the flower bud, and then when it's flowering. And they're beautiful little aphid that it's red. Mm-hmm. And when you come close to it, they kind of flash to, you know, to, hey, here I am and leave me alone, I guess. I'm not sure. But anyway, do you know what that aphid would be?
I'm trying to think. They're very common on all kinds of composites. You know, so I get them on coneflowers. I get them on black-eyed Susans, among other things.
Yes.
And I want to say goldenrod aphid, but I'm not positive off the top. I'm just blanking on the scientific
name. Oh, I wish it was a goldenrod aphid. That would be good.
Right. But, if you just do a search on red aphids, it will come up. In particular, this is a site, and this is a site you got to be careful of. It's an absolutely delightful site, but it's got more information than most people want. It's called Bug Guide. You just do a bug guide and put red aphid in the search, and the name will pop up. You'll see the exact pictures. You see multiple pictures. What Bug Guide is a database where people submit pictures, they get identified, and then we've got them. And the problem is if somebody says, I got this bug, is you've got probably 5 million pictures to look at. But if you have a specific idea like this red aphid and do a search, you'll probably get a number of creatures, both true red aphids and things that look like red aphids that are not. But I'm sure you can get a scientific name and some more background on it. But as I said, this is a common one.
Thank you, Phil. But I would be curious of the name, but I'm more curious of it's diminishing my seed production, mm-hmm. I think, and it's just exploded this year. Last year there was just a few. This year it's on 90% of the oxeye and a little bit of the coneflowers. Mm-hmm. Do you think I can expect that to just to continue, or maybe is it a cyclic thing?
I think it would be more cyclic. You know, there's all kinds of things that eat aphids. And what you always tell people, if you are patient enough, their populations will crash naturally. This is good because most aphids are capable of multiple generations a year, and we'd be knee-deep in aphids all the time if there wasn't all these good guys out there.
Yeah.
So as I said, what happens once in a while is things get out of whack, and the good guys don't control them like they should, and so we get these outbreaks. But typically, as I said, as long as they're not so heavy on the plants that it's yellowing and the like, the plants tolerate it quite well. And as I said, the norm would not be for heavy populations every year because it's a native species. It's in a better balance than you know, some of these exotic things that cause us trouble.
Yep. Jim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Alex in Warrens, it's your turn. Hi.
Hey, thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
We kind of have a problem with this bug that keeps showing up at our house. It's an insect, kind of spade-shaped, about the size of a dime. It's mostly brown with a few black spots and kind of a white triangle on its back. Now, the most interesting thing about it is when you squash them, they smell like bananas or apples. And I'm just wondering if you had any clue what it was and how to keep them out.
Is this more typically a fall and winter problem?
Yeah, mostly they start up usually mid-September is when they start getting, mm-hmm. we start seeing them a few times every couple days.
And how big is the critter?
I would say they're longer than they are wide, but probably a little bit bigger than a dime, close to a penny.
I'm somewhat suspicious that something we call a pine seed bug, or it's a leaf-footed bug, and it's like box elder bugs, is it tries to spend the winter. It has a very distinctive odor if crushed, and so if you've got a lot of pines or spruce trees around it, it feeds on the seeds of those plants. So western conifer seed bug is the most common species, although there are other ones. And so the invasion is happening about now for the next month or so. And so really where you try to head them off at the pass is making sure your vents are screened properly, that, you know, the things are caulked around windows so that they can't squeeze in, and they stay outside and they really don't cause a problem. The problem, though, is if they get access to your walls or your attic, and then every warm day in the winter, a couple of them wake up and come in, and at that point, you really can't do much. So, you know, either tightening things up or, worst-case scenario, if you're going to spray, you spray outdoors now rather than any other time to stop them. But do look up Western Conifer Seed Bug on the Internet to see if it fits.
And that would make a lot of sense because there is plenty of pine and spruce around us. We kind of live right near the pine forest, so...
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That would make a lot of sense. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And a Facebook question from Trudy, living in rural Duluth and have an infestation of quarter-inch-long silvery moth-like bugs. They hang out around the lights at night, inside and out. Seem to be coming out of the wood siding and wood paneling. When we touch them, they easily smear. Hundreds and hundreds of them, just pesty. A few years ago, we had them too, and then they, when they infested our camper, any idea what they are?
Yeah, would have to see. I've got speculate. I don't know if they're caddisflies or some kind of moth species. We do have some moths that spend the winter as adults, so just like some of these other things, they will crawl in so they could be. There's a poplar leaf miner, but without seeing a more specific picture, I'm guessing, because like I said, because there is a number of things that would fit that description and that behavior.
Email from Bill last week. Dr. Phil was quoted in Milwaukee Journal Sentinel concerning the tragic death of an individual to a wasp sting. Phil said the German yellow jackets have been in decline. Is this a trend going forward, and is it part of the natural cycle of invasives entering a new area in fantastic numbers and then eventually declining?
Well, that's what it feels like to me, because I go back to, although German yellow jacket has been in the state for about four decades now, but definitely the big problem years that we had with yellow jacket stings and problems trace back to the 80s and 90s, and boy, it's really just, it's disappeared so much that honestly we have a hard time finding them when we need them for research purposes. My colleague Dr. Jean is, and his students were working quite a bit with yellow jackets, and for the last number of years, Bob is since retired, but they just couldn't find enough to get their research done. And Bob was speculating that there are, you know, diseases or other things that kick in. And, you know, getting to be an old guy, the interesting thing is when I look at the pattern of these invasive insects in my career, whether it's Asian lady beetle or the like, even Japanese beetle in the Madison area, I would argue, is not near the headache it was in those first few years of establishment, and things do balance out. And that's a pattern that scientifically we've seen with invasives, is that over time things get better. Unfortunately, you know, with things like emerald ash borer, this is going to be a, you know, much longer, 150, 200-year cycle before we start to see relief from something like that.
That's unfortunate for sure. Let's see. Tom in Elkhorn has a question for you. Let's go to Tom. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just looking for a quick bug identification. It's about a quarter inch long. It seemed oval. It was black with a brown or a tan center. It almost looked like a stripe. It seemed a bit fuzzy, and at this point, I wish I would have flipped it over and seen its legs, but I did not see how many legs.
Where did you find the critter?
I was helping a house, or helping a friend get rid of a hoarder's home. So on the bottom of all this stuff were these weird bugs that I'd never seen.
Okay, I look up larder, L-A-R-D-E-R beetle.
Okay,
it is technically in the carpet beetle family, but this insect is associated more with high protein. In fact, it used to be associated with dried meats back in 150 years ago. But it also will breed on dead mice and other things, and so you do see accumulations. I've also seen them feeding on box elder bugs, any high-protein food source. And so it is a common creature you'd see indoors, and it would definitely fit your description. So as I said, I'm suspicious with where you found it, that it is a species of larder beetle.
There
is
you go.
Is there anything to worry about? No.
You won't see them in dry goods, like cereals are not high enough protein. I do see them in greasy dog food, you know, but then you'd see them in the bag of dog food if that was the problem. You know, if you know where the source is, you get rid of it. But if it's dead mice in the attic, I mean, it's not going to be very practical worrying about that.
Thanks, Tom. Rita in Green Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm intending to get, I'm hoping to get a praying mantis in the spring. And I have a plant room. I am having trouble with mealybugs right now. I did treat them with a granular systemic, and I'm wondering if the praying mantis eat the mealybugs, will it kill the praying mantis?
The systemic will not, but praying mantis would not be my choice. To be honest, if you're going to commercially buy something to control mealybugs, go on the internet and do a search for mealybug destroyer. It's a type of lady beetle that specifically eats mealybugs. You can order them live from places like Arizona Biological Supply. And so here I think it would be a much better match to get a biological control. So mealybug destroyer is the common name given to this little, it's a little blackish, slightly fuzzy species of lady bird beetle, and that would be a much better match.
Is there a problem with access, because this room has access to my house?
Well, they'll pretty much stay where there's food, although you might occasionally get one in, but you know, you're going to see this ebb and flow. If they eat all the mealybugs, they've got nothing to eat, so their populations will crash. and the like. But as I said, if you were looking for a natural control, that would be the creature I would look for.
Well, actually, I was looking for a pet.
For a pet?
Pet.
Well, you know, then if the mantid, you're going to have a couple problems. You're not going to be able to order an adult. You're going to order an egg case. And when they all hatch, you've got lots of little mantids, and you have to feed them fruit flies and a very small prey. And then as they get bigger, you got to get crickets. And so it really is a lot of maintenance. And if you get lucky enough to find a partially or full-grown mantid in the late summer, then you can bring it in. You can put it into a fish bowl and feed it crickets and keep it alive. But they typically will die out when you get into December or so. I mean, they're not a creature that can live a long period of time in captivity.
Yeah, how long do they normally live anyway?
Well, the normal cycles are basically hatching in the spring and in May and dying off in October or November. And so they said under good nutrition and whatnot, you might be able to keep them alive another month or so, but not a whole lot more than that, I wouldn't think.
So you got a short-lived pet there.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Hundreds of cluster flies every year, Jackie says, in 20 seconds or so. How do you get rid of them outside the cabin?
Now. You spray now. In fact, probably a week ago would have been okay. Numbers should be down in the southern part of the state because they don't have any earthworms to breed on, but they use pyrethroid insecticide, so you can get things at a box store, at the hardware store. Spray
on the
sunny
cabin?
Sides. On the spray the outsides of things, like permethrin and lambdacyhalothrin and the like.
That'll do it. And we'll be back with Phil Pelletier, UW Extension entomologist, after the news. As summer slides into fall, a lot of insect activity going on outdoors, and some are starting to come indoors as well. You may not be sure what's cause for concern and what's just an inconvenience. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network. We're lucky to have Phil Pelletier, UW Extension entomologist, with us for the next half hour to talk about the fascinating world of insects, and he's certainly willing to answer your questions or comments as well when you call in. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. If you have a photo and a question about that photo, or maybe you just want to post a photo, go to my Facebook page. You can go to the Larry Mueller Show and click there. Like the page while you're there. We'll send you regular updates. There are already several great insect photos up on the page, and you can add to that list. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We'll be back with Phil right after the news. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletier, UW Extension entomologist. Are you seeing some insects right now that are bothering you, or maybe you're just curious about them? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Have a photo? Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo or a question or a comment there. Be sure to click like while you're there. We'll send you those regular updates on upcoming show topics. John from, an email from John anyway. We have backyard chickens, and on the outside and inside of the chicken house, several yellow jacket nests. Can we wait till winter and then remove the nest when the yellow jackets are not active?
Well, in fact, you don't have to remove them. They're all dead. They don't reuse old nests. What happens in the late fall is they starve to death. They really don't freeze to death. And so I usually use the 1st of November as the cutoff date as far as when you can deal with them. And as I said, it really isn't important that you remove them because the new queens have already flown off. They're hiding under a rock somewhere, and they'll wake up next spring, and they're going to try to find a new place to set up housekeeping.
And a caller in Madison has fleas in his apartment, can't seem to get rid of them.
Do you have a pet?
Yeah. We had this yesterday on the show, as a matter of fact, with a person who had fleas in a two-unit apartment, and the people downstairs had both sets had animals with and fleas.
Yeah, the reason I asked the question is I've run into cases. 90% of the fleas I see are called cat fleas, but we find them dog, cats, raccoons, and possums. So if there's no pet available, the first question is, do you got a raccoon in the attic? And why this is important is you're busy treating your living space and the source is somewhere else.
Yeah.
The other side of it is it's more difficult to control fleas when you have cats because the cats cause the fleas to breed in places that are not accessible. And the biggest mistake people make is they buy a flea bomb and they think the bomb is fumigating their house. And so if the cat is spending time under the couch, that could be the breeding site. If you don't move the couch, the bomb doesn't get there.
Yeah.
So a lot of this is being a good detective. And And it's not so much a resistance problem that we're seeing as people not treating the proper places. So that's always the first direction we go is, you know, if your cat is crawling back in a closet somewhere, you got to get that base of the closet cleaned out and treat that, because that could easily be, or if it's down in the basement, and we have this problem sometimes, is there's just so many places to be, it really gets difficult. But the more stuff you got in your way, the more difficult it's going to be to get at the right source.
Mary in River Falls, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I had a question about sod web worms. I don't know a whole lot about it, but my lawn has been splotchy yellow spots the last couple of summers, and I do water it and try to take care of it. But I'm wondering if that could be the problem, and if so, how do you treat sod web worms mm-hmm. without using chemicals? Because I know they turn into those little moths that fly around, and I do have a lot of those.
Right, but you can't automatically assume that the moths you see are causing your lawn problem. I mean, lawns are mm-hmm. really difficult to diagnose, because everything that kills them causes spots, whether you know it's physical, disease, insect. There's two different kinds of webworms we have here. One has one generation a year that tends to cause damage in June and July. One has two generations a year. And typically the spots are about 4 to 6 inches in size. But the only time you can control them is when the caterpillars are feeding. And there are some organic ways of doing that. But I will tell you that generally when I see people refer to sod webworm damage, 90% of the time it's not.
Yeah.
So I think really what you got to do is try to get more of a correct diagnosis. So this is a case where taking a sample and sending it down to the turf diagnostic lab down in Madison, they're going to screen it for disease if it's webworms. This would not be the time to treat for webworms anywhere if it was. But, I my gut feeling is 2 years reoccurring, it more likely is a disease than it is insect.
Mm, there you go. Thanks, Mary. Joanne in Wausau, hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Hi. I have a question about on the south and east side of my garage. I have an infestation of red bugs. I thought they were box elder bugs, but they cluster, big cluster.
No, they are. I'm sure they are.
They're
this time
elders.
Of the year, they're box elder bugs.
Oh, okay. And they're not harmful, right? So leave them alone. There's red drops all over the white siding. But it seems to wash off when I water my flowers.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea to wash that off because it's protein based, and if it's stuck there for a while, it could be more difficult. And so again, if your house is really sealed tight, they don't really pose much of a problem there. If it's an older house, there's a lot of places to crawl under. Then, as I said, the problem is if you let them crawl under the siding, you will have a nuisance problem from now until next April.
Oh.
They don't hurt anything. They don't breed indoors, but they can be somewhat problematic. And I have seen cases where they're so numerous indoors, they get on white curtains and whatnot, and then those little spots do pose a problem.
Yeah.
There.
Well, they've left the house alone, and it is an older house, but the garage is detached, so they've stuck to the garage.
Oh.
So I'll let them there.
Yeah, leave them there.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Joanne. Rosie and Woodruff, hi. Thank you for calling. We got Rosie? Rosie must have left us. Let's go to Matt. Let's see if Matt's there. Matt, hello.
Hello. How are you today?
Great. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I had a question about nematoids. I used to garden indoors, and I used them to control spider mites. And I'm curious if I can place them around my tomato plants. They come in a sponge, and you put them in the water and then water with it. And I was curious if it would deter the tomato caterpillar. And the other question I have is, I've had a lot of problems with the Japanese beetles devouring my sweet corn and several trees in my yard, and I didn't know if there's something I can use that to take care of that.
Okay, well, two things. Where nematodes are most effective is against cutworms and soil-infesting critters, and so drenching them in the soil would do well for that, but wouldn't stop the hornworms and other things that are feeding above ground. So the problem when you spray them above ground is they tend to desiccate and dry out before they have an opportunity to do something good. So, as I said, I like them for things like iris borer in white grubs in the soil, but find efficacy is much less so when we spray them. Japanese beetle, the problem is they're coming in from down the road, and there are both organic and non-organic treatments. They only last for a few days. This thing is active for 2.5 to 3 months. So there are things you can do, but is things that are going to solve the problem? No.
No. There we go. Thank you, Matt. Going to our Facebook page, Ed emailed a photo of a beautiful spider amongst his reed canary grass. Mm-hmm. Can you see it there?
Yeah, it's from a group that we call orb weaver spiders. They all are common late summer, very colorful. This one is from a group we call Argiope or Argiope, depending how you want to pronounce it. It's often referred to as the black and yellow garden spider. And quite common, you know, just really colorful. I had two of them on my property, and somebody stole one of them, and whether it's a bird or something else, just, you know, I was taking pictures of it. They're great photographic subjects. They're harmless, you know, they're just...
And they make a nice web, too.
Yes, very, very big orb weaver, and then there usually is kind of a squiggly in the middle that they're often sitting next to, and it's just fascinating. In fact, we'd even feed her once in a while, and, you know, within a matter of about 20 seconds, she would have the prey paralyzed and spun up. And then you'd find that she'd feed on it at her leisure, and a day or two later she'd throw it out and wait for the next Japanese beetle or housefly, whatever we caught. So quite common late summer, kind of fun to see, but they do have their own problems out there. So,
Randy in Trempealeau County, hi.
Hi. So we've got some kind of a pest in our raspberries that's not the fruit fly. It's a somewhat hard-shelled black, probably less than an eighth of an inch.
I think they're picnic beetles. And picnic beetles attack fruit that is overly ripe, and then they'll plow into it. So it's all about sanitation, really. You try to get rid of the berries that are too damaged to eat. You don't want to just throw them to the ground because that draws them in. I have seen homemade picnic beetle traps where you just get a great big coffee can. You put in anything that ferments. And so whether you take a bunch of mushed bananas with a little soapy water, or, again, the raspberries. But the point is you don't put the trap in the middle of the patch because that draws the beetles in. You put it off to the side, you know, a good 10, 15 yards. So you're trying to draw the beetles to a more attractive food source than your raspberries. But the sanitation is more important than anything else.
Okay, great.
Thank you for calling. Email from Ellen. Our garden had way too many squash bugs and cucumber beetles. I attacked by pinching and a few applications of pyrethrin. Any overwintering problems if I clean up the vine carefully? I garden organically, plan to rotate the crop next season. And does the garden next door, who doesn't treat those bugs other than clean up at the end of the season, add to my problem?
Yes. Both those insects are mobile. Both those insects overwinter as adults. So the more plant debris that's around, the better it is. The frustration is even without the stuff next door, they are mobile enough that the problem could be coming from down the road. But the more you leave for them, the easier it is. For squash bugs, we've had some luck with taking an old shingle or a board, leaving it in the garden on purpose and having the adults crawl underneath it, and then sometime in November lifting it up and killing those overwintering adults. My problem with cucumber beetle is those are so mobile that they're probably, no matter what, going to fly somewhere else and then come back in the spring. But as I said, good sanitation is important, and then you might consider this kind of homemade trap as an alternative. The one other product you might consider that's organic is this spinosad product, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. It is pretty good for the cucumber beetles. It really is quite good for the squash bugs, and that would be a product that has a little bit more residual than the pyrethrum that you were using.
Judy in Menominee, Michigan. Hi.
Hi there. Two questions, both relating to keeping bugs out of the house. We moved to a house that had been sitting vacant for a year. We have a problem with carpet beetles. They're along the floorboards in the hallway, so you turn the hallway on at night, and they all start coming out. There's not as many now. We just, every time we did that, we'd kill everyone we could see, and they're diminishing. But we did read that a female could lay 300 eggs, and they seem to be different places all over the house. We have wood floors. We also, when we moved in, there were some, you know, quite a few things around, spiders and centipedes. The people before us had a person come in and spray around the house. We had never done that in the past. We're wondering if that's more effective to have a professional person come to spray around your house to keep bugs out, or do it yourself with home defense, or not even do it at all.
Well, in particular, the first thing with carpet beetles, they can lay lots of eggs, but there's nothing to eat. They don't breed. And so it's always about food source. But unfortunately, it can be animal hair, it can be feathers, it can be dead bugs and the like. And so to me, it's arguing that the problem is in the walls and not accessible. If it was in your living space, you could clean it up and be done with it. It may just be that food source is going to be exhausted and it will run its course. For other things, you know, I don't like spraying indoors all that much because,
no,
you know, as I said, this idea of spraying outdoors, whether you get professional help or do it yourself, it's often the same sprays that are available. They may have somewhat different formulations. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you think about it in our climate, you know, you put an application on in the spring, maybe another one in the late summer. That's all that really probably needs to be done. And okay. The question is, are you going to be thorough enough?
Yeah.
You know, that's where the one advantage of the pest control people that know what they're doing is they're going to spend the time nowhere to put it. But it's not as if they've got anything magic that you can't use. So it becomes more of a personal decision there. And as I said, if you're inclined to try to slow things down outdoors, putting one of these barrier sprays, I'd put one on probably in the first couple of weeks of May, and then consider putting another one on about the first week of September, and that's probably all you need to do.
And the home inspector, when he came around, there's gravel around the home and there's some bushes, and he recommends that everyone have 2 feet that you could actually walk around your home to keep out the pests and the bugs. I don't know if that's accurate.
Well,
or not.
I mean, it does help. They do those kind of things in food processing plants because they have zero tolerance. But I think, you know, landscape-wise, you know, I don't worry about the two things that I don't like to see is soil up against the siding, because aside from the wicking, that's how you get termites and a bunch of other things. But the other thing you can really look at is that interface, and we talk about this quite a bit on the show, between the siding and the foundation. If there's spacing up there, that's where the earwigs and the millipedes and the sow bugs all can crawl in. And so by expanding foam or steel wool or something to tighten that one spot up will make a significant difference for a lot of these nuisance kind of problems. Even ants, people find far less ants if they can get that interface tightened up.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And we've got a really cool insect that Cheryl sent us on the Facebook page. That's a mean-looking devil, but I don't know. I don't have a relation for size, but
yeah,
you know what?
It's a leaf-footed bug. The question is, what species of leaf-footed bug? Because I can't see enough of it. But the flaring of the last pair of legs is what's a giveaway. I don't think this is the western conifer seed bug because of the markings. There are a number of other species in that group. In fact, to be honest, this summer we had one sent in from the Wisconsin Rapids that was a state record. It was called a citron bug, something found in the southeast typical. And it was very similar to this with the spotting. I can't... As I said, see enough of it, but if you look leaf-footed bug and then kind of walk through, you might be able to get more of an indication. There are some of these species that are just found in the woods, don't hurt anything. None of them are really serious other than the citron bug is also a squash pest, so that was somewhat of a curiosity, but I've only seen the one specimen so far.
Facebook question from Kathleen a few weeks ago. A neon green caterpillar munched a lot of leaves off a cherry tomato plant. I thought it was large, 4 or 5 inches, fat, tiny black eyes. Couldn't find it after 2 days. The plant's still alive. Wondering what it might have been.
Yeah, I'm strongly, because of the size, it has to be one of the hornworms.
Yeah, I would say hornworm.
And what happens with the hornworm is they crawl in the ground to transform into the moth, and so they do disappear. Sometimes when you're digging, you find these 3 or 4 inch long, dark chestnut brown capsules, which are the pupal cases. And so they said, in the scheme of things, usually you can hand pick them to stay ahead of them. I mean, it's not something we normally spray for. Although this year, as everything has been more, there is a southern species that you could run into that you normally might not see. But generally speaking, I think they're more of a curiosity than anything.
Matthew in Elgin, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, guys. I got bit by a little brown spider last night. And I just, as I was calling in, I went to, I took a tissue and grabbed him and put him in a Ziploc bag. And as I went to go look at him right now, he's still alive walking in the Ziploc bag. So I would say he's a brown, he's got like a diamond shape, looks like a diamond shaped white spot on the second, he's got two kind of, let's see, he's about 3-4 millimeters long, the body, maybe 6. So maybe each little segment is 3 millimeters. And
yeah,
the
only way that you can identify a spider properly, to be honest, is to look at the eyes, which are probably something you're not going to be able to do. If you can take a picture of it, a pretty good picture, and send it to me, I can give you an idea. I'm suspicious of a species of jumping spider from the white spot, but that's a guess. And as I said, what makes spiders tough is the markings aren't as important as the size and the shape and the orientation of the eyes. Most spiders have 8 eyes. Sometimes they have a pair of big, two big ones and smaller ones. But without seeing that, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So I just kind of scared myself because I remember them talking about a brown fiddler. This wouldn't be one of those.
No,
guys,
the brown recluse does not have any white markings.
It's got a fiddle shape on its abdomen.
It's got like a white, for lack of a better term, it almost looks like a diamond
Look up jumping spider on the internet to see if that fits. Jumping spiders will bite on occasion. There's nothing necessarily dangerous about the bite unless it gets infected, and then as any infection. So if you start having, you know, some pretty nasty swelling and whatnot in the next day or two, that I would talk to the doctor about getting some antibiotic for the secondary infection. But as I said, if I had to take a guess, I'm guessing it's a jumping spider. It definitely is not a brown recluse.
Thanks for calling, Matthew, and good luck. Brad emailed us, need your help getting rid of a giant 4-inch long legged silverfish. They don't seem to be harming anything besides my poor wife's nerves, as they have a habit of hanging out near the light switches on our finished basement walls.
Okay,
she flips on the light and screams.
Yeah, the 4 inches has got me a little confused because the silverfish we've got are about an inch.
Yeah.
Even the giant silverfish, which is not that common in the state, is only about an inch and a quarter. Now, silverfish are kind of creatures that would more likely live in attics and in wall spaces. They're more starch feeders. There is some evidence they do better in moist conditions. So the option is to try to dry things out, but you can use an ant spray in the areas that you see activity, and that will have enough contact kill that one spray should give you between 4 to 6 months worth of residual.
Oh, easy solution there. Jody in Spring Green, hello.
Hi, this is Jody. I'm halfway between Spring Green and Dodgeville.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a beetle here that found it on the screen door after dark one night. It's about an inch and a quarter long, about a quarter of an inch wide. Long antennas, the antenna are an inch long. It's bronzy gold and has 4 white spots, 2 on each wing cover, oval white spots outlined in black.
Okay, the long antennae strongly suggest it's what we would call a cerambycid or longhorn wood borer. I want to say the genus Eubora, E-U-B-O-R-A, I think it is, although I'm guessing that off the top of my head with the markings, but it's definitely a longhorn wood borer, and these are typically firewood insects. You find them in dead and dying trees. Some of them are rather host-specific, but the adults are attracted to light. And as I said, the one that you've got, I don't even know if it's got a common name, But if you look under longhorn wood borers, and there's definitely a number of species. We probably got 70 or 80 species in the state, but there is one that fits that. In fact, the white spots are almost ivory-like.
Ivory-like. They look like a cowrie shell turned upside down. They're oval,
yeah,
and have a line down the middle. Well, that makes sense. We've got a lot of dead and dying trees out here right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Scott in Eau Claire. Hi, thank you.
Hello,
for calling.
Gentlemen.
Hi.
I have an insect problem in my tomatoes. It doesn't go with the cherry tomatoes at all. It's an heirloom variety of tomatoes. Never had it before. It has a shell on it. It's about a quarter of an inch long. It's black with white spots on it.
Yeah.
It's in the tomatoes. It's eating them. I just want to know what I should do this fall.
Well, see, the problem, it's a picnic beetle. And the problem is the heirlooms are inclined to crack. And so if it was an intact tomato like the cherries, they don't get in there. But if it's got an access point, it will be drawn in. Picnic beetles breed on decaying stuff. And so whatever you do isn't going to make a difference. There's always picnic beetles out there. They're just looking for the right conditions to draw them in. They get the name because if they're attracted to fermenting things. And so you put potato salad out there with a little vinegary smell, they come diving into it and crawl around the potato salad. So this is a case where overly ripe stuff you should try to remove just because it's drawing them into your garden. But as far as these causing a pest, something else has to open it up. And again, the problem with heirlooms is that by nature they're inclined to crack a little bit more likely.
Absolutely.
And this has been a great year for tomato cracks. And as I said, then these guys are happy to take advantage of that.
Yeah.
So normal garden hygiene and I'm okay?
Yep.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Someone was asking about ash borer, our ash tree. Where are we on that?
Well, you know, this year, new counties were Trempealeau, Waukesha, Walworth, Rock, as far as places we hadn't seen it before, and then infestations in Milwaukee and in Brown County and whatnot have kind of flared. So It was a disappointment to see all those additional new counties, but they're all pretty much adjacent to already known infestations. And with all that's going on in Illinois south of us, we're expecting this basically wave to move up,
push up,
and that's kind of what we've seen.
So we're gonna have losing a lot of ash trees probably.
Yeah, but it's still gonna be slow. I mean, I'm not still until it shows up in Dane County. I'm not worrying about the trees in our neighborhood. So.
No. Phil, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Nice to be here.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. He'll be back again. We'll do it all over again with him. Go to the Insect Diagnostic Lab and take a look there. It's a wonderful place. We've got a link to it on my Facebook page. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.